church itself, though, but it became the first in about six or seven things that the Eastern Church would remember years later in a bitter, angry mood. But they settled the date of Easter so that you could depend. Easter would always be on a Sunday, Good Friday would always be on a Friday. It's a peculiar thing, but if you change the date of Easter, then you also change. If Easter follows Passover, then Good Friday might fall on Thursday. Think of that. If you have a liturgical soul, think how it would be if Maundy Thursday was actually on Monday. But if you don't have a liturgical soul, then you perhaps cannot enter into all of those complications and those problems. I don't really have much of a liturgical soul, but I can immediately see the problem of celebrating Good Friday on Wednesday. It's just one of those things that you have to get with, you know. The whole calendar would be out of kilter. The bakery wouldn't know when to have the hot cross buns ready. So they settled that. I say that lightheartedly. The second thing that they settled was not permanent, but it was an interesting step. This was permanent. The settling of the day of Easter was never opened again. The second thing that they gave a judgment on, which was interesting to us, was the request of the Roman Church, the Western Church, that they should enact a law on the celibacy of the ministers, of the preachers. They suggested they should enact a law on the celibacy of the preachers, and that they refused to do. That they refused to do. At Nicaea, they determined that those who were bishops and ministers had the right to marry, as did other men in the Lord. Mr. Christian.
Are you talking about the presbyters or the bishops?
All parties at Nicaea. Anybody who held ecclesiastical office. Presbyter, bishop.
The request was to make all of them.
All clergy. The request of Hosius from Cordova, the Roman delegate, was to have all clergy be celibate.
Whether bishop or
priest. That's right. I'm sorry, I missed you there. Yeah, right.
When did they start calling
priests? Now, the term priest had been used, of course, the term priest is a biblical word. The term priest to describe the bishop is not used, though, till about the time of Gregory the Great in a formal sense, about 600 to describe the bishop in a formal sense. Although, it may have been used in this place or that, but formally he doesn't become that till about that time. The term priest does not become in vogue until the church is so complicated that one bishop has many local congregations and you need some finer definition of terms. But the Christians are called priests themselves fairly often, even in the early literature of the fathers. But the term takes on its official designation somewhat later. Yeah. So at this time, the clergy, presbyter, could still marry. Now, in all fairness, the Council of Nicaea, we do not have the document in which they said it. We have the historical statements of Eusebius relating it. And according to Eusebius, in all fairness, they pointed out that if a man was married, it could complicate his bishopric and whatnot. Because, you know, it could. But they also thought that he had the same right to be married in the Lord as did any other Christian. The West did not accept that as a permanent answer. The West did not accept it, and in due time, in 300 or 400 years later, there would be a celibate rule in the West, but there would never be a celibate rule in the East for the priesthood or for the bishopric. However, archbishops, they thought, should be celibate. I often have a tendency to say celebrate, and that is just a slip of the tongue, because I'm happily married. But archbishops, they thought, should still be celibate in the East. Those two decisions were settled. In addition to those things at Nicaea, they did a lot of minute stuff. I thought I would just browse through a certain amount of it with you this morning to make a point or two. And I'll try to make the point or two, and then I'll try not to come back to them with every council. But they passed 20 canons. I sketched for you one day the difference between a horos and a canon. The horos is the creed, horos. O with a rough breathing mark is the creed. And it was popularly thought that the horos could not be changed. It had the total mind of the church behind it. It was popularly thought that it was of the part and fifth of Scripture and couldn't be changed. But it was also thought that they would pronounce many canons. And those represented the temporal judgment of the religious body on immediate problems. So Nicaea enacted 20 canons. And all 20 of them relate to some form of administration or some problem within the framework of the church. I thought I would mention a couple of them to give you an idea of how things go. of the first canon. The first canon, they pointed out that eunuchs could serve in the church so long as their circumstance in life had not been self-afflicted. Those who had self-abused themselves, as in the case of Origen, could not hold office. And the father said that indicated a weakness in character that made them unworthy of the ministry. But persons who had fallen victim of the course of life and whatnot could still hold ecclesiastical office, the motive being more important than the actual fact. That's such a little thing. But they were working with this tremendous ascetic thrust from the world round about them. I've sketched that a couple of times, see. And it becomes very popular to teach someone that to avoid the problems of the world round about you, put out your eyes and you won't see any evil. And the fathers very quickly denounced any form of self-mutilation, which would be contrary to the holiness of the body in an attempt for a person to escape the particular problems of his day. And a number of statements are made along that line. And then here's an interesting point, I think. For this is the second canon. For as much as either from necessity or through the urgency of individuals, many things have been done contrary to the ecclesiastical canon, so that men just converted from heathenism to the faith, and who have been instructed but a little while, are straightway brought to the spiritual labor, and as soon as they have been baptized or advanced to the episcopate or the presbytery, it has seemed right to us that for the time to come, no such thing shall be done. And then the writer goes ahead and gives a long discussion in the canon on Timothy's words, Paul's words to Timothy about not elevating a novice. But he says, you often in the urgency of this situation have somebody who's converted, who's done a lot of things contrary to truth. If he's an important person, the tendency is to promote him immediately to prominence. Now, so the church father, it's our advice that this not be done. If you can't see the practical thrust in the nature of that, then you have missed a lot of action in the last few years. They ought to learn, he says, before they're promoted to some position of prominence, they ought to learn in the framework of the church the principles and decor of the scripture. Likewise, they give an interesting law on housekeepers. You'd wonder that the synod would spend so much time, but the great synod, they describe themselves with modest terminology, the great and holy synod, the great synod, the infallible synod. The great synod has stringently forbidden any bishop, presbyter, deacon, or any one of the clergy, whatever, to have a subintroducta, that is, a woman servant, dwelling with him, except only a mother or sister or aunt, or such persons only as are beyond suspicion, like conceivably a wife. But it's a tiny enactment, see? But it says no clergyman will have a woman living in his home as a caretaker, subintroducta, one who serves under him, unless, of course, it's like his mother, who conceivably is beyond suspicion, or his aunt, who hopefully, or his sister, or someone like that, caring for his particular needs. What you quickly glean, if I read all 17 of these canons, it would make a long hour, but what you quickly glean is the simple fact that most of the problems in the church were not big doctrinal problems, but they were problems of polity and practice. You quickly glean that. And you soon discover that in the ancient church, as well as in the modern church, our big challenge is not from giant heresies, but from misbehavior on the part of professing Christians. And the 20 canons go over that several times. I think I will read only one more of them. Only one more. It struck me as an interesting one, but you might find the idea interesting. Canon 10. If any who have lapsed have been ordained through the ignorance or even previous knowledge of the ordainers, this shall not prejudice the canon of the church. When they are discovered, they shall be deposed. Deposed. What? Where's my coffee? Deposed. Ooh. Yeah, they will be deposed. So see, the church in effect says that if you have violated the canon of the church in this previous matter of lapsing and giving up the faith, that is not forgivable without a long period. However, they make this note in the next canon. Concerning those who have fallen without compulsion, without the spoiling of their property, without danger of the life, as happened during the tyranny of Licinius, the synod declares that though they have deserved no mercy, they shall be dealt with mercifully. As many as were communicants, if they heartily repent, shall pass 3 years among the hearers. For 7 years they shall be prostrators, and for 2 years they shall communicate with the people in prayers, but not without oblation. Now here's a peculiar thing. I only read that canon to get to one particular point. The church easily developed a structure, of authority within itself. And in that particular capacity, you pick up the three big offices. You have the hearers. Then you have the prostrators. And then you have the catechumenal. We'll just say catechumen and save ourselves that much right. He wanted to aspire to ecclesiastical office in the early church. Now, by the time you get to 325 AD, it's hardly the early church anymore. The church has been in business for about 300 years. But by the time of Nicaea, if you want to aspire to ecclesiastical office, you go through a threefold step in the framework of it. The whole body of the church is called the communicants. The whole body, everybody's a communicant, from the bishop on down. But then if you wish to promote yourself or go through it, in order to attain ecclesiastical office, you first become a hearer. A hearer is somebody who sits and listens to the scripture and conceivably studies it. You secondly become a prostrator, an individual who throws himself in prayer and dedication to the work of his church. And eventually you become a catechumen, somebody who studies and answers the right questions. I oversimplify those things. When you go through those three stages, and then when you've gone through those three stages, it may be the mind of the other presbyters. A presbyter's appointment. It may be the mind of the other presbyters to advance you to being a presbyter or an elder in the framework. But by the time you get to that, you're about ready to preach, they thought, Mr. Upman.
It's interesting, we had this missionary here at school last year, a medical doctor in Africa, and his church, he had almost exactly the same system. First you were a street witnesser, then you were a Bible study leader, and then finally they make a decision.
That was Dr. Campbell, the Moorish work, or the Muslim work. Yeah, that's right. You'll discover that these things are devised chiefly to kind of make sure that those who aspire to leadership really want it. And if they can't, that was Dr. Bryson.
Right.
Yeah, that's another story. Chiefly to make sure that those who aspire to leadership really want it and really have the qualifications for it. And we always launch out and point out and say, in the ancient church, nobody was ordained because he wrote a doctrinal statement and eight fellows would pronounce him fit to preach. Whether it's right or wrong or not, you agonize a long time in a training process or training cycle. Now, you could be one of the communicants all your life and not do any of these things. You just come and go and stand appropriately and that sort of thing. But in this area, it was a considerable training cycle.
Wouldn't you be here if it was just a...
Not necessarily, no.
Where would we be?
They'd be over here. But there was a role of deaconess in the early church, and in that sense, women were found among the prostrators. Now, whether they went through the hearing section or not, that I don't know. But there were deaconesses, and they were chosen out of the prostrator roles. And so, in that case, as far as I know, women were never found among the catechumenal. But there are some blanks in my knowledge of those things. Well, there were a lot of other offices, too. It soon became a very, very structured thing. And as I said earlier, the thing that hits us in church history is how did that small apostolic band become a great machine like we kind of recognize today? Well, it did it in all of these rather devised ways. Most of these things originated because of some need, some promotion quickly of somebody who really didn't believe much, the coming of some novice who, for the first time the church board voted against him, he quit. So most of these things arose out of need. And of course, when the circumstance is a matter of conviction, you can have all the stringent requirements and regulations that you want. I was going to read you another canon, but I think I will bypass it in the sake of expediency. I'll simply tell you about it. See? Now, the father said, we've observed that people like to kneel at Easter, and they like to kneel at Easter and kneel a couple other times when they pray. So otherwise, apart from Easter and whatnot, they felt that when people prayed in public worship, they should stand in respect to the deity. And standing became the order of prayer in the early church, in the Nicene church. Standing became the order of prayer, and it remained the order of prayer until sometime after the Reformation period. It really remained the order of prayer until the induction of benches into the churches, which comes about 1700 AD. In the earlier days, you stood, and of course you got a lot more people in that way, and you stood sometimes for hours. And my heart still pounds when I realized that when the Westminster Assembly met, the first thing they did was have a session of 2.5 hours of prayer in which the first man prayed for an hour and a half. I don't know if he recited theology, the creeds, or what he did, but he prayed for an hour and a half. Of course, it was all done standing. Well, if you pray standing, you're more or less likely to go to sleep than if you pray kneeling. But I don't know how much, I don't know if you pay better attention or not. I don't know if you look for a wall to lean against. I just don't know. Of course, they often prayed standing looking up, too. See? It's peculiar how the customs go to us and all that sort of thing. Today, if a man stands up and looks out at the audience and says, let us pray, if he's like McCrae, for example, Dr. McCrae, you know, if he closes his eyes and bows his head, tends to lose his balance. So he tells you to pray, and then he looks like he's going to close his eyes and bow his head, but he never does. After you bow yours, he straightens up again. Praise God. I often look when people are praying. But see, we've developed this ritual thing. If you don't bow your head and close your eyes, you're hardly sincere. Don't you kind of feel that way? You know, if you sat in a circle of friends and they all just sat there and looked straight at you and began praying, wouldn't you feel there was somehow something? You feel that? And of course, the eye closing bit came to be part of having your mind taken off of worldly distractions. See, when you're talking to God, you shouldn't be looking at a bowl of fruit on the local table. And so all of those things. But you quickly discover that traditional trappings clutter the church rather rapidly. And as soon as you become contradictory of them or very hostile towards them, if you're not careful, you'll discover they're with you too. Yes, sir. Now, I want to say one snappy word about the contributions, Nicene contributions, to theology proper. The theology proper, the big contribution was in the role of establishing the Trinitarian idea. Tertullian had advanced the Trinity. Irenaeus seemed to know something about the Trinity. But the big idea was the establishment of the Trinitarian idea. The exact wordings of the Father, the Son, and we believe in the Holy Ghost. That's no small thing. No small thing. In Christology, the chief contribution was laying the assurance that Christ was eternal. And that question will never be debated again in a formal council. Although in the next 20 or 30 years after Nicaea, a lot of people will argue it out. But it will never be debated again in a formal council. And finally, in ecclesiology, the Council of Nicaea shows the developing church and the developing church system. It shows the increasing power of the bishop, and it shows a lot of steps in what we call the sacerdotal developments in the church, the way in which you do certain things to get grace. Sacerdotal, from sacra, sacred, dotal, from didymi, in a composite form to give grace, things that give grace. After a while, see, just going to the service gives grace. You get points in heaven. 10 service on Sunday, 10 points. Prayer meeting, 5 more points. Wear special vestments, 3 points.
About the concept of purgatory to develop at this point? Or?
No, sir. Purgatory, as that is in any clear statement, is not really seen in hardly any concept until about the 6th century. You begin picking up little aspects of it. And that isn't even purgatory. It's the idea of, well, it's purgatory. But in a pure sense, it's not purgatory.
In some of the stuff that I've been reading, they give the implication that they pray for the dead sometimes.
Yes. Yes, there seems to be some indication that they pray for the dead. Perhaps not having an understanding that was full of 1 Corinthians 15. And there's some evidence that some of the fathers baptized for the dead. You know, the 1 Corinthians 15 passage. So there's some indication that there were prayers for the dead, but not on an official level. That seems to arise in the perimeter of individual opinion and individual people, where you'll find a lot of strange things. Purgatory may have a mythological base in its purest form. After it gets a grip in the church, the Roman theologians attempt to take it to Matthew 6 and to 1 Corinthians 3. But it seems to have had its earlier stage in a mythological sense. As a formal doctrine, it's a good ways off yet. Yes, and as a necessary doctrine, it doesn't really come as a necessary doctrine until Trent, something you've got to believe. Up to that point, you could believe it or not believe it. So that roughly is the contributions of Nicaea in an overall sense. After Nicaea, there was a furious resultant state. It caused a lot of funny things happen, but let me browbeat you with this point. See, starting with Arles in 314 and Ancyra and the other councils, starting with those councils, in the legalized state of Christianity, the state paid the bill for the councils. Did I say that the other day? You see what a terrific hold that is. The state paid for it. The state called them. All the councils are called by emperors. They are all held to the point where the emperor suggests. They are all enforced, and their decrees are legislated by the emperors. Now, you don't have to be a genius or have 3 degrees in political science to see that anybody who is unhappy with the way a council has gone knows that if they can change the mind of the government, they can change the things they're unhappy with in a council. Do you see that? Having already told you that the brain will flee, you can see it quickly. You better say it, though. I don't mean it quite that nastily, but see? If I control your church, and we make a decision at the business meeting that you don't like, you know instinctively that if you can get me to change my mind, then we can have another meeting, and I controlling your church, I can change it the way you follow that thinking, don't you? So, the government paid the bills. Constantine supported the council. Constantine's army carried out the decrees. No if, and, buts, or whatnot. It became obvious to the Arians that if there was a change in the governmental economy, the whole Nicene thing could conceivably be overthrown because the whole creedal period is just at its inception. Consequently, the Council of Nicaea was hardly over. Now, my imagination is about to go to work, so be careful. See, it's hardly over. Constantine is just about to leave. He's getting ready to walk out. And up to it comes Eusebius of Nicomedia. He had been an Arian, but he had signed the creed. Only two men didn't sign the creed, one of whom was Arius himself. If you didn't sign the creed, you didn't wait till the council was over. Packed your bags and they sent you to wherever they sent those fellows. And the council is hardly over. Now, Constantine is about to walk out. Eusebius of Nicomedia walks up to him and says, "Great council, Constantine." That's my imagination. "Great council, Constantine. Emperors are like creatures. They are subject to flattery in a ferocious way." The emperor says, "Well, I'm glad you liked it, Eusebius. I'm sorry that you were on the wrong side." "Well, that's how it goes, Constantine. You win some and you lose some." Over the next 8 or 9 years, Eusebius of Nicomedia would butter Constantine up to the point where the emperor would change his mind. He would conclude that the real troublemakers were Athanasius and Alexander. And it was done strictly by Eusebius of Nicomedia and a couple other guys, but those men in particular working behind the scenes. They found a couple of Constantine's followers who weren't so good. Marcellus of Ancyra. He proved to be a kind of a hopeless mess as far as a bishop was concerned. And it was easy for Eusebius of Nicomedia to say to Constantine, "Look at the kind of guys that support this doctrine." And so in 10 years, by 335, he had changed the mind of Constantine. And Constantine determines that the Nicene doctrine is wrong, that Athanasius is a troublemaker, that the only way you can have peace is to change the creed, either adopt Eusebius or Caesarea's creed, or something new. He's ready to start the whole thing over again. They actually have a number of councils in Constantinople. They're not ecumenical because they're not world invited, but they actually have a couple councils. They decide that Arius is really right. They're going to bring Arius back and reinstitute him as a bishop. He is 80-some years old, and the night before they're going to reinstitute him as a bishop, he dies. Athanasius puts out a news bulletin the next day saying, "God's justice overcomes men's evil." Or, I even dare to say that, but you can feel what he said. "God," he said, "we're going to bring this heretic into the church." God took his life. Arius' followers said, "Well, when you're 80, who knows what will happen?" The excitement was too much for the old boy. But because of Constantine's vacillation, there would be about 40 years of heated debate in the church. And of course, Constantine would soon die himself. Constantine was baptized on his deathbed by Eusebius of Nicomedia. Constantine had a funny view. He didn't want to sin after he was baptized. I'm not sure that you can do that even by being baptized at the last minute, I'm feeling humorous today. The last, you look up and say, "Well, I know I only have 2 seconds. I'd like to be baptized now." And just as they apply the water, you say, "Boy, that's cold." Well, complaining is certainly sinful. Think of that. But Eusebius of Nicomedia baptized Constantine on his deathbed. and constant, and the result was great confusion. See, when the emperor changed his mind, a whole bunch of vacillating clergy, whatever the ruler says, they'll do it too. Whoever pays the freight calls a lot of shots in this life. You had better believe it. And that's why if you have some very wealthy fellow who's always giving you stuff all the time, be sure to make it plain that he's not buying your soul, your allegiance, or your sacred honor, but it's pretty hard to do. A friend of mine used to have a doctor in Philadelphia, and I was in seminary. The doctor would never charge preachers. This fellow had a little church in North Philadelphia. The doctor never charged any preachers, rabbis, clerics of any sort. And the result was he had the biggest ecclesiastical practice in North Philadelphia. And this friend of mine said they had just gone through some tremendous illnesses. The doctor came to the hospital and went to his office and he wondered what he should pay him. And the doctor said that he didn't charge clergy and so forth. He hoped when he died they would bury him free too. And you know, this fellow said to me, he said, the hardest thing, he said, that I've done in 5 years, he said. And he said, a fellow had to do it. He said, the hardest thing I've done in 5 years was looking him right in the eye and telling him that by doing clergy favor to clergy, you didn't save your soul. He said, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. He said, we sat down and discussed it at great length. He said, inwardly, I thought he would hand me a big bill. don't scoff and say, why should it be hard? Life is kind of like that when you're a peasant. But as soon as the emperor changed his mind, a lot of vacillating clergymen of various levels changed with him. And the result was there were 40 years of strife. But there was no further ecumenical council until 381. And that will be Constantinople. Now, as I said the other day, there were no doubt parts of the world where these problems didn't really make much difference. But in the East, it was giant confusion. Council after council would be convened, but the Nicene Creed would not be overthrown by them. Although you'd have some that were mastered by Arians and by other groups, the creed itself would remain. Here's a peculiar thing. The greatest asset to the Nicene Creed came in the next several years when the Arians couldn't get along with themselves. The Arian camp will divide about six ways. And if you can be patient, one of the greatest helps to truth is the fact that falsehood can't exist as a single unit either. That's one of the greatest helps to truth. Heretics usually begin chewing on each other. And if you can wait till they start to bite each other, that's a great help to truth. Now, I think at this time, it will take us about a 10-minute break. It's now 9:10. All those who have gone this far in the academic life know that that means we will return at 9 o'clock. There are always a few who don't. So, 9 o'clock, right? If I come down to get coffee and you've got the place jammed up and I can't get it, the break will be extended to 9:11. 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock. Okay. I'm back at the same switch. There are some things you have to remember. And there are a lot of things you can forget and won't make any difference. And some things you have to remember won't make any difference either. But I always emphasize that you ought to remember that the big problem in the Ante-Nicene period was in theology proper. You ought to remember that, just so your knowledge is complete. You ought to remember that the big problem in the Ante-Nicene period is theology proper, and that most other problems were kind of secondary to that. Theology proper took the major amount of attention at Nicaea. In this settling of the Trinity type thing. Underneath all ages, the ecclesiological problem will be big. Ecclesiology is always with us. And as I said in the last class, kind of feebly, 90% of the time of the fathers will be spent ironing out all sorts of things, like can a bishop smack a presbyter if he, you know, I state that humorously, but a lot of time is spent that way. And you'll find an increasing amount of it, and after a while you go to church board meetings where they'll spend 2 hours arguing over how much salt you can buy for putting on the sidewalk when it's icy. And in 5 minutes, we'll decide when the next big evangelistic crusade on PL. You know, it's kind of that way. So in this connection, I will go ahead to the Council of Constantinople, remembering that from 325 through the next half century, really, the next 50 years, there was considerable argumentation over the Nicene Creed because of the vacillation of Constantine and his sons. Constantine changed his mind. Constantine's sons can hardly think the same way twice at all, and his successors are very weak. But by the time you get to 375, that problem is waning because the Arians are fighting with themselves. The Arians fall down into three or four major camps. And of course, the pure Arians become obnoxious. For the pure Arians like to say, he was not God. See, they like to say it in a big way. So the more plain most heresies become, the more emphatic they can become, usually the easier they are to deal with. We had a couple of years ago in this area, I don't know if any of you were here or not, it's hard, I can't remember who comes where, and I also don't like to be overly condemnatory in my judgments, but in this area a couple of years ago, there were announcements at every store building of a big lecture on archaeology, Near Eastern archaeology, and modern finds that was to be given over here in the Lower Salford High School. Well, it isn't every day that you get two or three fellows that have just been over digging in Palestine to come and have a big program, and it isn't every day that you see one put up in the local community. So my initial response was, who's doing it? All you had was the name of two professors and two characters. Now, one of the professors' name was tolerably well known to me, but I have no idea of knowing what he was ecclesiastically. He just has articles that show up in the journal of Near Eastern Studies and stuff like that from time to time. Well, I'm always interested in who puts the thing on as much as I am in putting it on, so one of our students, who is a zealot, called and asked. And the fellow said, well, he said, just interested Christians who feel the Christian community ought to see these confirmations of biblical truth. That is nice, too. But after a while in this business, you become enormously suspicious of anybody who's interested in just doing anything for the benefit of interest. That's why it's with literature we write for biblical truth. We just want to help you. Yes, and we just want you to help us. It kind of hits both ways. Well, there was no way of really finding out, and it was on a night when I was unable to go, which is most nights. So, I had this zealous student who had a keen eye for heresy and heretics. He could spot one, as Dr. McCray would say, 0.1% of Arminianism at 1,000 yards. So he went. He came back the next day with a kind of a smug look on his face. He said it was a great lecture and great slide presentations. He said it really was. He said, I haven't seen anything better in years. And he said, then as we were leaving, he said, they handed us this literature. The literature was Adventists. Now, there are worse groups than the Adventists. They were a model group, but the literature was Adventists. And one of the pieces of literature took up the Sabbath question, and a couple others took up all sorts of other things. He said, they handed us this literature, and I looked at the fellow and said, are you Adventist? And the fellow said, certainly not. He said, certainly not. And well, I said, this is Adventist literature. Of course, by now, I don't remember the exact conversation. The student says, I said, well, this is Adventist literature? And he said, no, just Christian literature explaining certain points of doctrine that the average man ought to know, he thought. Well, you'll discover after a while that the clearer heretics become, those who are contrary to the delivered opinion of the weight of the body, usually the easier they are to avoid. And the Arians got fighting among themselves, and the very pure Arian groups began writing slogans on the wall, he was not. They made themselves obnoxious, and that became self-defeating in time. And so as the Arians fought more among themselves, the Athanasians, there eventually came to be quite a happy union between a far-out left-wing Arian group who actually came to feel that the homoousian views of Athanasius were closer to their own position. So by 375, that problem was pretty well resolved. The Arian group had discredited itself, and the Nicene group was triumphing, I think, because it was closer to truth. But that is a kind of a prejudicial opinion, of course. However, standing off in the wings was another problem. And this other problem that stood off in the wings was in the teaching of a fellow called Apollinaris. Apollinaris. A-P-P, well, just spell it however you'd like, and I won't argue with you. Apollinaris. He, too, is a like Arius, a personable fellow. And his problem is considerably different than that of Arius. I want to read you Schaff's evaluation of it. This is Philip Schaff, a great historical theologian of the last century. Here's Schaff's evaluation of Apollinaris. Apollinaris was the first to apply the results of the Nicene controversy to Christology proper, and to call attention of the church to the physical and pneumatic element in the humanity of Christ. But in his zeal for the true deity of Christ and fear of a double personality, he fell into the error of a partial denial of his true humanity. Adopting the psychological trichotomy of Plato, soma, psuche, pneuma, for which he quoted 1 Thessalonians 5:23 and Galatians 5:17, he attributed to Christ a human body, soma, and a human spirit, psuche, allogos, the anima animans, which man has in common with the animal, but not a rational or human spirit, nous or pneuma, and put in the place of the latter the divine logos. In other words, in order that Christ's deity would not be affected in this God-man thing, Apollinaris said, he has a body like yours. He has a soul like yours. But he does not have a rational or reasoning spirit like yours. He is two-thirds human. Are you with me on that? He is two-thirds human. But he is not totally human, because Apollinaris apparently feared that if Christ had a human spirit, he would be so reduced to creatureness that the Arian economy would seem to be right. Now, in the case of Apollinaris, he so stresses the deity of Christ that he makes him less real in his humanity. It's easy to remember it that way. It's overly simplified. But he so stresses the deity that he, in essence, denies the reality of the humanity. Now, it doesn't make a lick of difference whether you were a trichotomist or a dichotomist in the ultimate end of this thing. The end result is that Christ is not fully human. And the reason for that in Apollinaris' thinking is if he's fully human, he might lose his godness. So what you have in Apollinaris is the first of a long line of men whom I think are real believers, but who are trying to solve a problem in the personality of Christ, which the scripture itself does not solve. And as soon as you begin to work on a thing like that, you run into imminent danger of heresy. That's kind of the way it goes. Are you with me there? See, there's a difference in Arius. Arius says, no, there was a time when Jesus wasn't. Arius, too, has good points, incidentally, but he looks around and says there was a time when Jesus was not. At best, he's a created being. Not so, says Apollinaris. He's God. He always was God. He's God who took on a body for our salvation. But in taking on of that body, he did not fully become like us. He failed to see the concept of the God-man in Timothy, which the apostle just spits out and doesn't try to explain. There's one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. He makes no attempt to explain it. He gives us that little song, Great is the Mystery of Godliness. He makes no attempt to explain it. And our minds are sometimes unwilling to accept anything like that. Now, you can also have a lazy mind and not try to explain anything. But you know, it's like the little kid. My wife was babysitting years ago for the children of John Buswell. John Buswell taught for the last several years at Covenant Seminary. He's out preaching somewhere now. We were all good friends. My wife was babysitting the Buswell children. The Buswells had a church in center Philadelphia. The children were three and four years old. Little girl. One of them was a little girl. I don't remember exactly. Maybe they were both girls. They were both married today, whatever they were. But anyhow, they had a church in the heart of Philadelphia. So I say the heart, I mean, brother, the heart. Grass hadn't grown there for 40 years. Even the park was stone. So my wife is babysitting the Buswell children. She's telling them a story about a pig. My wife is a great storyteller, which is good. But she's telling the story about a pig. And a little Buswell girl said to her, she said, "Miss Ruth," she said, "what is a pig?" Well, well, my wife began to tell her what a pig was. She said, "Well, a pig," she said, "is an animal that has four legs." "Oh," the little girl said, "like a dog." "No," my wife said, "not quite like a dog." Now, anything she said about the pig, the little Buswell girl supplied another animal that was like, which wasn't like it at all. My wife tried to draw her a picture, tried to find one first, couldn't find it. Tried to draw her one second, and had the artist, she is not.
Kiss the nurse line like.
After a while, we had to accept the fact that the Buswell girl could not be made to understand what a pig was at that time. But we hoped that with due process of time, especially if she would develop a kosher taste, we hoped that with due process of time, she would know what a pig was. Now, I'm sure she did. I'm sure in the next 20 or 30 years, she learned it well. But whatever the case happens to be, there are some things you can't fathom. And the theologian is well to have that in mind. Thinking unthinkable thoughts, leave that for politicians like Senator Fulbright and those guys. You can also quit too soon. You know, the fellow said, and he says, "Well, do you understand Ephesians 2:7? "No, I don't understand it. I don't think about it." So you can quit too soon in this business. But there are certain things not resolved, and whenever men have attempted to resolve them, a heresy has resulted. That's Apollinaris' problem. He's a nice, pleasant fellow. He had a big following. He was popular beyond belief. But he was trying to demonstrate the person of Christ in logical proportions. And he was afraid that he would lose the deity if he admitted him to be fully man. Now, 1,600 years later, we're prone to look back and say, well, it's just an academic matter. But most of those things were not academic, either in themselves, but especially in what they led to. And if the view of Apollinaris had been accepted, the great likelihood is it would have soon led to a kind of a docetism that in the next few years there would have been nothing human about Jesus at all. But it tends to go that way. You hardly ever make a pronouncement that stops there. It's the next step that you have to look to with almost any kind of pronouncement. I've got to get I'm in a lecturing mood this morning, which is bad for you, I suppose, and bad for me too. But the emphasis on Apollinaris is just that. So the council, oh, go ahead, Mrs. Stewart.
No, I just had a question, maybe it's a question point, but in all these heresies, they all boil down to either someone's either trying to emphasize the humanity of Christ.
All try to do that very thing. That's right. So I will not elaborate on it further than that, I don't think. I'll merely point out that the council did meet. Theodosius called it. 150 bishops came on page 63. In my notes, I have printed the Constantinopolitan creed that they produced. The Constantinopolitan creed that they produced. And on page 63, by using my baby typewriter, I have printed the Nicene Creed beside it. So that you can see the Nicene Creed with your left eye while seeing the Constantinopolitan creed with your right eye. If your personality is that split, you deserve notes like this. There's not a lot to be said here, but note what they say, and note the basic essential addition. One Lord Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son of God, begotten of his Father before all worlds, light of light, very God of very God, begotten, not made, being of one substance with the Father, by whom all things were made. That substantially is just repeating the Nicene Creed with a couple added adjectives. Who for us and for our salvation came down from heaven and was incarnate by the Holy Ghost and the Virgin Mary, was made man and suffered again and so forth. That too is emphasizing the Apostles' Creed and binding the old Apostles' Creed together with the Nicene Creed. So that far, you have simply picked up the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed and kind of bound them together. He suffered, was buried, the third day he rose again according to the Scriptures and ascended into heaven. We believe in the Holy Ghost. That too is emphatic. We believe in the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. We acknowledge one baptism for the remission of sins and look for the resurrection of the dead and the life in the world to come. Now, they have said all of those things, but have not said anything in specific reference to the Apollinarian problem, in that they have not attempted to resolve the particular issue. Do you follow me on that? The creed is printed there so that you can read it. They have not said he has two natures, one nature, or three natures. They have not said he is dichotomous or trichotomous. They have merely reemphasized the position of the church that is begotten, not made, and that he did certain things in our behalf and will do certain things in time to come. So what they have chiefly done is to quote Saul. What they've chiefly done is to solve the Apollinarian problem by, that's quotes on the word solve, by merely reaffirming what the church already believed and not giving grounds for any further division or derivations out of that belief. In short, in a creedal sense, they did not really take up the Apollinarian problem. Gregory Nazianzus was moderator for the last half of the council. And Gregory said, well, look what we already believe. Apollinaris, look what we already believe. Now, you're wrong. Look what we already believe. And so they made no attempt in the creed to divide between the person of Christ and to say, yes, he is human in these three parts, and yes, he is divine in those three parts. They fell back to what I think is basic common sense, but it doesn't always solve the problem. They fell back to a reiteration of that which the church believed in itself, the perfect manhood, without stating it, the perfect godhood, by implication, of Christ and the vicarious or the substitutionary work. So in effect, they did not deal with the Apollinarian problem, in effect. But in reality, they did. Now, if that is too complicated for you, and that's too complicated. Let me read to you a couple of the canons from Nicaea, from Constantinople. The first canon they enacted was that the Nicene faith, as pronounced in the previous thing, would be confirmed. It would be confirmed. It would be confirmed, it would stand, the Nicene Creed would be emphatic. The second canon that they confirmed was the fact that the various bishops would rule in their own territories alone and not meddle with anybody else. The third canon they confirmed was the fact that the Bishop of Rome had the honor among the bishops. He did not have a ruling thing, but he had the honor of position. Then they disavowed one critic. Then they talked about the bishops. But in other words, throughout all of the canons, Apollinaris himself is never really mentioned until you get to Canon 7. Canon 7, which has a troubled text in the history of the church. Here's Canon 7. Those who from heresy turn to orthodoxy and to the possession of those who are being saved, we receive according to the following method and custom. Arians and Macedonians and Sabbatians and Novatians, who call themselves Cathari or Aristeri, and Quartodecimanians or Tetradites and Apollinarians, we receive upon their giving a written renunciation of their errors and anathematize every heresy which is not in accordance with the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church of God. In other words, the only mention they give the Apollinarians is how they can get back into the church. And what they have to do is write out a statement. They denounce their former heresies. They confess that what the church has said is right, and they are received back. So in essence, Constantinople really did not deal, and yet really did. It really did by saying the orthodox things that we believe or the things that were pronounced at Nicaea are the things that we believe and they are the things that we affirm. And then they repeated those things, added to them notes from Christ's work and office, and let it go at that. And in effect, they said that the Orthodox will see this and believe it, and they'll recognize that Apollinaris is outside this particular circle. So what they did was not to make the circle tighter, but to restate it in an emphatic way. Is there any question there? There was quite an argument over what we would call the priority of the sees. In all the years that the church was illegal, you mostly thought in any case of any one community of having one church. As I mentioned the other day, you take Alexandria, for example. Take Alexandria right here, for example. In all the days of the illegal status of Christianity, when they had no buildings and properties, it was popularly thought that there was one church, even though they might meet in 50 homes. They had no giant cathedral where you could have two services with a vested choir. So they met in homes, buildings, public places, parks. But it was always thought that there was just one church in Alexandria. And consequently, there was one bishop, one episcopoi, one overseer for that total church. He would have many presbyters under him who would preach and teach and do the work in all the local groups. But he was thought of as being the episcopoi of that territory. Do you see that pattern in your mind, class? See, it's not at all like today where you go into a town, here you have the First Congregational Church, and here you have the First Methodist Church, and here you have the Church of the New Light, and the Church of the Apostolic Faith, and the First Baptist. Nothing quite existed like that in the first three or four centuries. You certainly had divisionary groups, you know, Montanists and whatnot, hiding here and there, but by and large, it was thought that all the Christians in Alexandria belonged to the church, to that particular body. And there was an episcopoi elected by the presbyters and so forth. But the episcopoi couldn't be everywhere, so he had presbyters out preaching here and there, duly appointed men. Now, with the legalization of Christianity, it began to be possible to build, and a little before the legalization, but it was hard, began to be possible to build individual worship houses. And so you quickly began to have worship houses out here. But you still had one bishop. And they never really thought of calling this presbyter a bishop. He was still a presbyter under this episcopos fella back here. So you wound up with this episcopoi man running, being responsible for that work in Alexandria. Now the question is, what happens when a small group of Christians go down to Dogpatch, which is a small town just south of Alexandria? What happens when a group of Christians move to Dogpatch? Do they call bishop? Well, in the earliest part of the church, like in the first century AD, they would have elected a bishop of their own. But now we're beyond that. We're at this sophisticated stage. They look back to this fellow in Alexandria and they say, how about sending us a presbyter down here? And he soon becomes, so that the bishop of Alexandria soon becomes a bishop over a big territory, all the way over to Carthage maybe, or over to Hippo, see? He soon becomes the bishop of a big territory, more by accident than by design. Now the same thing happens in Italy. Because the Roman church is by far the biggest church by the 3rd century, just by virtue of population. So the same thing happens in Italy. So the bishop of Rome is responsible for the suburban churches all around Rome, up and down Italy, back and forth. He's responsible for all. Well, it becomes very easy for him, or for any bishop, to want authority over other bishops. Power is a real corrupter. And the concept of Peter having gone to Rome is very ingrained in church tradition. So the bishops of Rome, from at least the 1st century AD, from Clementine down, thought of themselves as successors to Peter. But in the case of Clement, he shows no indication he thought he was better than anybody else. But they thought of themselves as successors to Peter. Now, starting in the days of Cyprian, they began referring to the bishop of Rome as being the first among equals. That if you put all the bishops in a circle and said, which is the most important bishop position, that the church would say, well, the Roman bishop is the most important. We're all equal, but he's the first among equals. In other words, if you're all equal and somebody says, who's going to speak for the group? Nobody can speak if you're all totally equal. So they'd say, well, we're all equal, but he has the priority spot among equals. Of course, many of the Roman bishops were not happy with that, and they began claiming that they were more important than the Bishop of Alexandria. So at Constantinople, the Constantinople fellows say, the Bishop of Alexandria, he'll be bishop there. The bishop in Constantinople, he'll be bishop there. Every bishop will have his own bishopric. the Bishop of Rome will be regarded as a primary place. Constantinople, however, will not be inferior to him. That's what they mean in that. I'm sorry to give you that long tirade, but that's what they mean by it. They mean that the Bishop of Rome is really an important fellow, and so is the Bishop of Constantinople. But each one is still only responsible for his own sphere of church.
Sir Jesse. I think it's interesting that they did that in Constantinople. Was there any resistance? I don't understand it more than they did in Rome. The councils in Rome, being in Constantinople.
The Roman bishop never liked it. He was glad to be thought of as having a primary place, but what most Roman bishops wanted after, say, the legalization of the church was more than that. They wanted absolute authority. That starts out very quickly.
Well, how did the Bishop of Constantinople feel about that?
Well, I think that in the case of Gregory Nazianzus, he really propagated it. He was really the pusher of it, and he, of course, is an Eastern bishop. He felt that Rome was the center from which Paul wrote his letters, the center from which the church sprung, and he thought it was noteworthy that most of Paul's letters to the Asia Minor churches were written while Paul was in the prison of Rome. And in his mind, that allegorically was very important. So he himself was a pusher of it, and even a man like John Chrysostom in a few years will. But see, they really are not giving Rome authority over them. They're just saying that if you line up the 20 bishops in the world, this particular position is more important than the other 19. It's like in the theological faculty. Mr. Christian.
To what does the term see refer?
See refers to the area of churches around any bishopric over which he has oversight. It's C-S-E-E-E. S-E-E-E, rather than S-E-A. It's the area over which the bishop looks. Episcopos is an overseer.
The bishopric is a church, and the see is a territory.
That's right. Yeah, episcopos, looking upon a thing, and so that kind of a thrust. That's right. Mr. Morris.
In the development of church history, as these bishops sit in the chair of Rome, in the Roman chair, does that make them feel that even as time went on, as growth has increased and stuff, and make them feel their actions were always right because they occupied that chair?
Well, in the Western world, it certainly did in time. In the Eastern world, that was never accepted. In other words, the Patriarch of Constantinople never accepted that. But the Western bishops, the whole church didn't feel that way. How do I want to say that? Infallibility was never considered part of the papal authority until about 1870. That's when infallibility showed up. Although a lot of popes before that felt they were infallible. But as far as the rule of the church was concerned, it was never felt that. And even then, of course, was only limited in this matter of ex cathedra. But individual popes, individual bishops certainly felt great power, like individual preachers. I have a lot of friends who are just pastors of independent churches who really have what I call a papal view of the ministry. All they have to do is have one member of the board say something contrary to their opinion, and they'd like to cast him out of the synagogue. You'll discover that that particular feeling of power and rightness is by no means limited to Rome. But I think individual ones certainly did, Mr. Morris, but the rank and file of the church certainly did not. It's a fascinating thing. Yeah, I have a long tirade in that subject, which I usually save only for campfires in the summer when I'm out camping with my friends. But you have to be careful, or this infallibility mentality creeps over you rather easily. And it's a good man who can go to a board meeting with his pastor, with his co-workers, say, either with his co-workers or with his deacons. It's a good man who can go with them, and they can all look at him and say, well, we think you're wrong in this point, brother. It's a good man who can say, well, maybe I am, see, or words to that effect, or reconsider. This concept of infallibility is like a disease. It is a kind of a necessary occupational illness in the ministry. And usually, the bigger and more successful your work is, the more keenly you feel it. When I was in Akron years ago, once preaching, 700 people had just left the church in Akron. They were gone a couple months before they knew they were gone. It was a very large church, so 700 people left to start another church. And the pastor of the church from whence they had left said, well, he said if they didn't want to stay where the truth was, they could go wherever they wanted. He was a big independent rascal, but I said to myself, he may not know it, but if he were Pope, we'd all be in trouble. That's what you call the infallibility mentality. And it really is pretty deadly. You don't have a big church. It hits lots of little fellows. You'll hear fellows in chapel occasionally. They'll stand and look and they'll say, and I said to my church, if you... we'll leave that for Grawley's course. But it's a big problem. However, we'll leave it for Grawley's course. Yeah. So that's both the Constantinople thing and the creed, and its rough contributions. Its rough contributions I've summarized in my notes again. And really, it's really a reaffirmation of what had been done. Its biggest single contribution, apart from reaffirming Christology, was this matter of appointing the ecclesiastical sees. And Constantinople makes it very plain that in the church in 381 AD, no one bishop was in himself a regulator of other bishops. The whole bishopric system just kind of grew up. And for those in the modern age, look back and say, well, is it biblical? A lot of other things like that. It seems that most of our machinery is not biblical on any church level, not directly stated biblically, most of it. But a lot of it is necessary, and God certainly gave us heads to exercise sound judgment on setting up the machinery. For example, a choir. What is less biblical than the choir? Unless you follow David's choir pattern, and most of you couldn't take that much brass in your choir. I love to hear those trumpets play. I don't know why more of our churches don't have all the instrumentalists sitting down front on Sunday morning, belting it out. I love to hear it. But, yes, Mr. Upton, deliver me from this tyrant.
Well, it's been suggested that the early church, I mean, when they were being persecuted and going from house to house and beach to beach, naturally they couldn't have choirs. You know, kind of a necessity thing rather than a dogmatic.
They just had gifted soloists who went along and stuff. Whistlers. Now, I'm not knocking it, Mr. Eichmann. I'm just pointing out that a lot of the things we do are not specifically warranted and they're not militated against. But many people will see this bishopric kind of thing and they'll really be appalled at it. But you'll discover in every closet there are some spiders. That sounds profound, but I'm not sure what it means. Mr. Jeff,
is it possible to trace the big split that comes between Rome and Constantinople back to this step of making the bishop the honorary, Roman honorary?
It actually becomes part of the problem, as does this Court of Decimanian controversy. Those two things become part of that problem.
So this is one of those things.
Well, this is not a major one, but it's ancillary to the whole.
Yeah.
Set the stage, however, for what we call the Third Ecumenical Council. The Third Ecumenical Council at Ephesus in 431. There were two big issues at Ephesus. Two big ones. One in Christology on the person of Christ, and one in anthropology on man's ability to receive grace and salvation. Two big problems at Ephesus in 431. Let me just sketch quickly, without all the historical trappings, the Christology problem. The Christology problem developed in the teaching of Nestorius. I've given a long quote in my notes from Peter Toon's book on the subject, and if I read it out loud again, I won't understand it again. So in a nutshell, it's this, in a nutshell. Nestorius overacted to the Apollinarian problem, and Nestorius stressed the humanity of Christ to such a degree that his deity was rather minimized. Not denied, but minimized. Nestorius was the bishop of Constantinople for a period. And he was keenly anxious that men be able to identify with Christ in his humanity. He never denied Christ's deity. But his emphasis on, as far as we know, his emphasis on his humanity was such that he made the deity almost unmeaningful. Consequently, he gave a lopsided picture of Christ, which, if carried into the next age, would either make Christ hardly God or make you God. Now, let me elaborate on that further. As I mentioned the other day, we've had a big rash of neo-Nestorianism in the last few years in theology, and we will probably have more of it. It's in the teaching of these men who tell you that all that Jesus did was not done in his own power, but done only in the power of the Spirit. So that while he was on earth, he never did anything out of his own deity. That's a teaching which is on the loose again and shows up about every 150 years. And this happens to be the unlucky age when we have it with us again. You'll discover that most of the teachings and most teachings are cyclic like most truths. Today we've had a lot of arguments over the charismatic things, but that's merely the repetition of a cycle that runs in about 80-year cycles. If you live 100 years, you'll see it again with greater emphasis, probably. Those things are cyclic and in proportionate that way. But the neo-Nestorian thing is a kind of a cyclic thing, too, and so the result is you get a certain number of teachers who say, well, how can we follow the example of Christ if he's God? And the obvious response is, you don't follow the example of Christ if he's God, you follow the example of Christ as man. And the resultant thrust comes to be, well, how can we see what Christ was like as man? We read the Scriptures. And the ultimate point is, everything he does in the Scriptures is done as man, and you ought to be able to follow it. His miracles, his powers, his works, they're done as man, totally yielded to the Holy Ghost. Do you see that thrust? I don't say agree with it, but that's because it's really a bad teaching. Eventually, what it does is make Christ much less than God. It doesn't do that on the first issuance, that's where it leads. And it makes a lot of people like you think that you are God. So we wind up with all kinds of great professors. Mr. Christian.
So the problem with Nestorianism isn't so much a problem as the natures of Christ, as was Apollinarius, or the person of Christ that was Arian, but just how Jesus Christ himself lived while he was on earth.
It is that along with a little question as to his nature and how much the human dominated the divine. But it certainly is that latter point very emphatically.
Okay. Although he was, they would say, although he was fully divine and fully human, the part of him that we see in this earthly life was mainly the human.
Yeah, you don't see the divine at all, but you just see the human. And the ultimate is that if you were as yielded to the Spirit of God as he is, you could do what he did. The only reason you can't walk in the water is not that your feet aren't big enough, but you're not yielded to the Spirit.
So in other words, they would say that he is divine because he is divine.
That's right. He laid them aside completely. Now the standard terminology is the kenotic theory, the kenosis theory, is a neo-Nestorian. But of course, it's been rather roundly condemned, so it kind of shelved for a while. We've come up with a whole rash of new thinking. Mr. Upton?
The term kenosis in itself doesn't imply heresy, though. I mean, it's just theory built around the fact that don't people, when they refer to like the Philippians 2 passage, they say that kenosis is just
a lot of times I don't know what to say exactly. If you could get paid for thinking of smart remarks, I would be one of the highest paid of all people.
No, I didn't.
I'm just trying to answer you.
I've never heard this as a heresy.
Well, it's one of those you'll need to research. The word kenosis in itself, of course, is no different than any other word. The word in itself is neither good or bad. It's in the application of it. And no orthodox person applies the application of the kenotic theory in Philippians 2. Some heterodox persons do. But that's the heart of the kenotic, kenotic section, the kenotic problem. It's hard to know sometimes how to answer and say it accurately. Well, what I was saying a moment ago was that's the Christology problem. The story stresses the humanity to the point where the divine is made almost obscure. Let me at the same time give a word on the anthropology problem. The anthropology problem grows out of the teaching of Pelagius. Pelagius' name should be known to you. P-E-L-A-G-I-U-S, Pelagius. He was really an Anglo-Saxon whose Anglo-Saxon name was Morgan. And it would be better if we called him Morgan, but then nobody would know who you were talking about. It'd be like calling Erasmus by his Dutch name. No one knows what it was. Only a few very erudite persons even know those things. So Pelagius, we call him. Pelagius began, well, Pelagius fostered a teaching that man was not inherently sinful and that he could save himself. He fostered the teaching that since man was created in the likeness and image of God, he had all the powers of will that God had, and that if he wanted to, he could stop sinning tomorrow and never sin again. He fostered a self-atonement concept of salvation. Be good and save yourself. Pelagianism, roughly speaking, is a term which means, in theology, self-salvation. I don't mean the word means that, the term has come to represent that. So Pelagius' ideas were basically that man could deliver himself. He did not have to be a sinner. Now that's a hopeless oversimplification, but that's the very heart of it. Mr. Christian.
Then how did Pelagius see Christ's death, or in what light did he see the death of Christ?
He saw Christ's death in what today we would call the moral influence idea. Christ's death showed you how unselfishly you ought to live. But it did not atone for you. You had to atone for yourself. So he saw, Pelagius is really a far-out type. But sometimes, like Hitler, the bigger the lie, the more believers you come up with, and things of that sort. That's a little crude way to put it. Pelagius fell into bitter disputes with Augustine, of course, so Pelagius' followers. I don't think Augustine, Pelagius himself, ever did any more than play one or two bingo games at the terrace of St. Teresa. But Pelagius' followers and Augustine came into close contact. And Augustine, of course, was the great stressor of grace. Augustine's theology, which I have tried to sketch in my syllabus again, is a pure and simple grace theology. Man can't do anything to help himself. Man doesn't do anything to help himself. Man doesn't even feel any internal need to do anything to help himself until God, by grace, alerts his conscience and gives him the power of faith to believe. Augustine is very extreme on that point. Or if extreme is the wrong word, say emphatic, but he's very something on it. Consequently, in Pelagianism, you had the concept man is basically good, he ought to be able to save himself. In Augustinianism, man is inherently evil because of sin. He can't help himself at all. Mr. Grossman.
Suppose somebody chose to sin. Christ had no effect?
Had no effect. You could be in and out of the kingdom today and tomorrow.
Well, what about past sin?
Past sins,
the few people, I assume you claim that somebody will do that, sinning.
Mm-hmm.
If you did.
Past sins to be overcome by supererogation type works. You doing good deeds, you could have. He's kind of the balance type, you know, the scales in heaven, good deeds and bad deeds. Of course, the problem with all men like Pelagius is they take such a narrow definition of sin. Choking your mother-in-law to death is hardly a sin. I mean, they take such a narrow definition of sin that that's the problem with all Pelagianists and perfectionists, incidentally. They take such a narrow definition of sin. And the result is when you define sin as only one of about three extremely wicked things, then they don't feel like they're sinners anymore. Well, I had that problem before I was a Christian. I felt very good because of what I didn't do. Well, I had no biblical concept of sin. And so the fundamental thing to both Pelagianism and perfectionism is a very narrow or restricted view of sin. And in essence, a lot of things that would otherwise be called sin are not sin as long as you don't get caught. So when you start that way, you easily come to that kind of situation. But Pelagianism was largely a problem in North Africa and Italy. And the Nestorian problem was largely a problem in Asia Minor. Those are the two major problems facing Ephesus. There's virtually no discussion in theology proper. That particular doctrine has been settled. Of course, there are lots of discussions continuing in ecclesiology and eschatology, but theology proper has been largely settled. The big heart of the fight, and this is rather important, the big heart of the fight is between Nestorius, bishop of Constantinople, and Cyril, bishop of Alexandria. That's an awfully important bit of minutia in the infighting bit of the church. Cyril and Alexandria. Cyril is very fond of a term which is used by Athanasius and others. He's very fond of the term theotokos. Theotokos, out of the Greek theos and the verb tiktoko. Tiktoko. You have a contract form and a non-contract form, depending on whether you like to be Doric, Ionic, Gothic, Greek, or whatever. Greek, see, is a Greek is what we tell everybody they should study assiduously in a seminary and hope that they will do it, but not to bug us too much with whether you say Omicron or Omicron. Just do it. Theotokon means the God bearer in the sense of giving life to, the one who is the mother of God. Theotokos is translated crudely, mother of God. Church history, I always get the viewers confused, because Nestorius was willing to say that Mary was Theophoros, the one bearing God, that is, carrying God, but not giving birth to God. But Cyril of Alexandria, following Athanasius and others, said that the Virgin of Matthew was Theotokos. She was the one giving birth to God, God incarnate. And in that sense, it's hard to argue with Cyril. Then he says, well, there's just one person. That's the God incarnate. She certainly is the mother of Jesus, and in that sense, the mother of God. Now, because we have a Protestant tradition behind us, that always shakes us up a little bit. We don't like to hear that. We don't like to hear it. But there's a sense, see, in which unless you think Jesus was just another number in the maternity ward, there is a sense in which she must be recognized as the mother of God, God incarnate. I leave that for Dunsweiler in theology class. He always gets the boys confused enough on the subject that Hassel and Gloss showing the Jesuits. Whatever the case is. Theotokos. And Nestorius would say, no, she, whatever else Mary is, she's not Theotokos. He's willing to say Theophoros. From Pharaoh, see, Theos and Pharaoh, the one who bears or who carries God, but not the one who, quote, begets or borns God. She borned a child. That doesn't sound like good grammar to me somehow, so you have to work that for yourself. Mr. Christian.
What relationship does Nestorius, this findings for Theophilus, have with what he told us earlier about his minimizing it? The action of the deity in the life.
Yeah, it has considerable reaction. See, he's willing to say, of course, see now Nestorius doesn't deny Christ's deity. That's very important.
Right.
Christ is divine. He's willing to say that Mary carried the God-man. She carried God in that sense. That she carried God. But she is really the mother of Jesus, Jesus, the humanity. So the thing for which Mary is totally and solely responsible is the humanity, which is the thing that we're really interested in. Because it's that God is kind of shadowy in the background. It's that humanity that we follow and get our exampleship from.
So there's not necessarily a close, but there's a somewhat of a tie-in between that and some of the other, like, monarchianism that we talked about before with the
well, it's very remote. It's very remote, and it really becomes a matter of the semantic logistics. Because, see, Nestorius is, Christ is a separate person, and he is divine. He's not just a manifestation of the Father. He's really divine. But the divinity part of him, the divine part of it, is kind of put in the closet while this human scene goes on. That's quite different than monarchianism, where the person of Christ doesn't really amount to much.
Well, logically, the divine Logos had to come upon Jesus at some point in the story. And he didn't want to put it at birth.
No, he does put it at birth. He does put it at birth, but in effect he thought it had nothing to do with Mary. And that the birth of the person should not be spoken of as the birth of God. Maybe it should be spoken of as the emission of God, or the emanation of God, but not as the birth of God, because he felt that that meant that the physical was as divine as the spiritual. The deeper you go, the more complicated it gets. The more complicated it gets. See, in essence, I don't know if I can refine that or not. I'm about out of time for today, but fortunately we have tomorrow. On Thursday, and Friday, and next week. But in essence, what Nestorius is saying is, Mary cannot be called the mother of God, because the physical was not God. The spiritual was God, but the physical was not God. The physical was the personification of divine manhood for us. But the physical, which was born of Mary, is not God. The total person, God. The physical, not God. It's a complication in terminology that results whenever you try to split the person up, I think. In the case of Cyril, Cyril was saying, look, there's just one baby Jesus. He's man and he's God. In the sense that he's God, Mary can be called Theotokos, the mother of God. No, says Nestorius. She can only be called the mother of the human body, which is awfully important, because that's where we get our lessons, that's for our life and so forth. But the human body is still so totally human that it's no different than we are in any aspect of its character. So you can't call her God-mother, with the human body being her only production. Mr. Chesney.
Well, Nestorius would have a problem with the Christ being conceived by the Holy Spirit.
I don't know. I would think I don't know.
Well, in essence, what he's saying is that Mary gave birth to a human child, and God replaced the human spirit with his spirit.
Well, God was there. God was there all along. But the thing that was important was not the body is the important thing. Because in that body we have our example, in that body we see the suffering, in that body atonement is made. But the body itself is not divine. It's human like you are, so you're not divine, your body is not divine. And the body of Jesus was substantially no different than your body in any part. Well, we usually say in Orthodox circles that the difference was that it wasn't marked by original sin. If you stuck a pin in him, he would still bleed. Bite a fingernail too deeply, it would still hurt, because there was no markings of sin, and so forth. We'll come back tomorrow, probably. Some of us will. Maybe I'll put the lecture on tape and go ice fishing. 8 o'clock tomorrow.